For almost 20 years now, she had been waiting to discover the truth. She closed the door behind the young Mr. Matthews, whose countenance left little doubt as to his dejection, and watched each step of his retreat from behind the kitchen window. Only when he had cleared the garden path and latched the wooden front gate did Lucy let out the breath that she'd been holding. She turned away from the window and stood for a moment with her back against the glass, surveying the room. Uncanny though it seemed, all was exactly as she remembered. It was as if she had merely stepped out for a walk to the village, become waylaid, and returned 2 decades later than expected. The house was quiet, but it did not feel still. Lucy was reminded of a story Edward used to read to her from a book by Charles Perrault, La Belle au Bois Dormant, about a princess cursed to sleep within her castle for 100 years, the inspiration for his Sleeping Beauty painting. Lucy was not a romantic person, but she could almost imagine, as she stood by the kitchen window, that the house knew she was back, that it had been waiting. Indeed, Lucy had a most disconcerting sense that she was not alone in the room. She reminded herself, however, even as the hairs on her forearm tensed, that she was not of a suggestible disposition, and that to begin to fall prey to superstition here and now would be a deeply regrettable slip. Her mind was playing tricks on her. The reason was clear. Steeling herself to her purpose, she crossed the hallway and started up the central staircase. The bentwood chair was exactly where she'd last seen it, on the corner of the landing where the stairs made their turn. The chair was angled towards the large glass window overlooking the back garden and beyond it the meadow. Sunlight spilled through the glass and countless motes of dust drifted in unseen currents. The chair was warm when Lucy sat gently on its edge. The landing itself too. She remembered now that it had always been so. The last time she had sat here, the house had been filled with laughter and passion. The air had thrummed with creativity. But not today. It was just Lucy and the house. Her house. She let the air of the old place settle around her. Somewhere out there in the great green beyond, a dog was barking. Closer by, in the mulberry room downstairs, the wall clock was keeping count. Lily Millington's clock, still ticking. Lucy supposed that the lawyer, Mr. Matthews, had made sure that it was wound. She still remembered when Edward had bought it. Lily's father was a clockmaker, he'd announced, whisking the package into the hall in Hampstead. I saw this on the wall of a fellow in Mayfair and exchanged it for a commission. I'm going to surprise her. Edward had always been a giver of gifts. He thrilled in the gratification of selecting well. Books for Lucy, a clock for Lily Millington. It was he who had given Thurston the rifle.
A genuine baker, carried by a member of the 5th Battalion of the 60th Regiment during the Napoleonic Wars.
Impossible to believe that she was sitting here now because Edward was dead, that she would never see him again. Somehow, she had always supposed that one day he would come home. They had not seen much of one another after the summer at Birchwood Manor, but Lucy had known that he was out there. Every so often a note would arrive, scratched on the back of a piece of card, usually begging a few pounds to pay a debt that he'd gathered in his travels. Or else word would be passed along the grapevine that someone had seen him in Rome, Vienna, Paris. He was always on the move. He travelled in order to escape his grief, Lucy knew, but she wondered sometimes whether he also believed that by moving fast enough, often enough, he might find Lily Millington again. For he had never given up hope. No matter the evidence to the contrary, he never could accept that she had been involved in a deception, that she had not loved him with every bit as much devotion as that with which he had loved her. When they met that last time in Paris, he had said,
"She's out there somewhere, Lucy. I know it. I can feel it. Can't you?"
Lucy, who had not felt anything of the sort, had merely taken her brother's hand and held it tight. After climbing into the hallway hideaway, the next thing Lucy had remembered was opening her eyes in a bright room that she did not recognize. She was in a bed, not her own. She was in pain. Lucy blinked, taking in the yellow-striped wallpaper, the lead-light window, the pale curtains hanging either side. The room smelled faintly of something sweet, honeysuckle perhaps, and gorse too. Her throat was parched. She must have made a sound, for Edward was suddenly beside her, pouring water from a small crystal jug into a glass. He looked terrible, more dishevelled than usual, with a drawn face and anxious features. His loose cotton shirt was hanging limply from his shoulders, giving the appearance of clothing that had not been removed in days. But where was she, and how long had she been here? Lucy was not aware that she had spoken, but as Edward helped her up to drink, he told her that they'd taken rooms for a few days in the public house in the village.
Which village?
His eyes studied hers.
Why, the village of Birchwood. Can you really not remember?
The word was vaguely familiar. Edward tried to reassure her with an unconvincing smile.
Let me call for the doctor, he said. He'll want to know that you're awake.
He opened the door and spoke quietly to someone on the other side, but he did not leave the room. He came back to sit on the mattress beside Lucy, encasing her hand in one of his, stroking her forehead lightly with the other.
Lucy, he said, a look of pain in his eyes. I have to ask you. I have to ask you about Lily. Did you see her? She went back to the house to fetch you, but no one's seen her since.
Lucy's thoughts were swimming. Which house? Why was he asking her about Lily? Did he mean Lily Millington? She was his model, Lucy remembered, the one with the long white dress.
My head, she said,
realizing that it ached on one side.
You poor love. You fell. You've been out cold. And here I am, asking you questions. I'm sorry, I just...
He raked a hand through his hair.
She's gone. I can't find her, Lucy, and I'm terribly worried. She wouldn't just leave.
Lucy had a flash of memory then, a gunshot in the dark. It had been loud, and there'd been a scream. She'd run, and then... Lucy gasped.
What is it? Did you see something?
Fanny!
Edward's expression darkened.
It was terrible. A terrible thing. Poor Fanny. A man, an intruder. I don't know who he was. Fanny ran off and I went after her. I heard the shot when I was near the chestnut tree, and I ran inside, Lucy, but I was too late. Fanny was already... And then I saw the back of the man running from the front door towards the lane.
Lily Millington knew him.
What?
Lucy wasn't sure exactly what she meant, only that she was sure that she was right. There had been a man, and Lucy had been frightened, and Lily Millington had been there.
He came to the house. I saw him. I went back to the house, and the man came, and he and Lily Millington... talked.
What did they say?
Lucy's thoughts were swimming. Memories, imaginings, dreams were all as one. Edward had asked her a question, and Lucy always liked to give the right answer. And so she closed her eyes and reached into the pot of swirling noise and colour.
They spoke about America, she said, a boat, and something about a blue...
Well, well, well.
When Lucy opened her eyes, she discovered that she was no longer alone in the room with Edward. Two other men had come in while she was concentrating on her brother's question. One of the men was wearing a grey suit. He had ginger sideburns and a moustache that curled at the ends, and he was carrying a black bowler hat in his hands. The other was dressed in a deep navy coat with brass buttons down the front and a black belt strapped to his round middle. His hat was on his head and had a silver badge on its front. It was a uniform, and he a policeman, Lucy realized. As it transpired, they were both policemen. The shorter man in the blue uniform belonged to the Berkshire Constabulary and had been contacted because Birchwood Manor fell within his jurisdiction. The grey-suited fellow was an inspector with the Metropolitan Police in London and had been brought in to render assistance with the investigation at the request of Mr. Brown, Fanny's father, who was wealthy and important. It was Inspector Wesley of the Metropolitan Police who had spoken, and when Lucy's eyes met his across the room, he said again,
"Well, well, well."
Adding this time,
"Just as I suspected."
What he suspected, as he was to tell her over the coming days, after a thorough search had been carried out and it was discovered that, just as Lucy had suggested, the Radcliffe Blue Diamond was missing, was that Lily Millington had been in on the whole thing.
"A mighty deception," he announced through his moustache, his thumbs tucked into the lapels on either side of his coat. "The most scandalous and brazen scheme. The pair of them hatched it well in advance, you see. The first step was for one Miss Lily Millington to win a place as your brother's model, whereby gaining access to the Radcliffe Blue. The second step, once your brother's trust was won, was for the two of them to make off with the prize. And there it might have ended, had Miss Brown not caught them in the act and paid the price with her blameless young life."
Lucy listened to this scenario, trying to take it all in. It was true what she had said to Edward. She had heard Lily Millington and the man talking about America and the blue, and she could remember now seeing a pair of boat tickets. She had seen the pendant too, of course, a beautiful blue diamond, her family's heirloom jewel. Lily Millington had been wearing it. Lucy had a clear picture in her mind of Lily Millington in a white dress, the pendant fixed in place within the hollow of her neck. And now, Lily and the diamond and the tickets were gone. It made sense that they were together somewhere. There was just one problem.
"My brother met Lily Millington at the theatre. She didn't seek him out to become his model. He rescued her when she was being robbed."
The inspector's top lip quivered with pleasure at the opportunity to bend a pair of innocent ears with tales of the seamier side of life.
"Another ploy, Miss Radcliffe,"
he said, lifting a slow, solitary finger.
"As devious as it was effective, another deceitful double act, the two of them in it together. We've seen how the likes of them operate, and if there's one thing certain to gain the attention of a respectable gentleman like your brother, it's the sight of a beautiful woman in need of assistance. He was helpless but to respond. Any gentleman would have been, and while he was busy restoring the woman to rights, distracted by the rendering of care and concern, the fellow, her partner in crime, returned, accused your brother of being the thief who'd just made off with his sister's bracelet, and in all the ensuing confusion..."
He flung his arms out to great dramatic and triumphant effect.
"Slipped his fingers into your brother's waistcoat and pocketed his valuables."
Lucy remembered Edward's account of the night that he met Lily Millington. She and Claire and Mother, even their maid Jenny, who was listening from where she was pouring the pot of breakfast tea, had exchanged fond, knowing glances when he told them that he'd had to walk the whole way home because he had been so transfixed by the young woman's face, so excited at the prospects that it presented, that he'd managed somehow to lose his wallet. Forgetfulness in the face of inspiration was so in keeping with Edward's nature that none of them had thought to question it, not to mention his wallet had been as empty as it ever was, so recovering it was of no great consideration. But according to Inspector Wesley, the wallet had not been lost at all. It had been taken, stolen from Edward by that man, Martin, at the very moment that Edward had believed himself to have been coming to Lily Millington's rescue.
"You mark my words,"
the inspector said,
"'cause I'll eat my hat if I'm wrong. A man doesn't spend 30 years wading through the rot and filth of London streets without learning a thing or two about the despicable elements of human nature."
And yet, Lucy had witnessed the way Lily Millington looked at Edward, the way they were together. She couldn't believe that it was all a ploy.
"Thieves, actresses and illusionists,"
the inspector said with a tap to the side of his nose when Lucy said as much.
Cut from the same cloth they are. Great pretenders, tricksters all.
Viewed through the prism of Inspector Wesley's theory, Lucy could see how Lily Millington's actions might not have been exactly as they had seemed. And Lucy had observed Lily with the man, Martin. That's what she had called him.
What are you doing here?
She'd said. And,
you must go, Martin. I said a month.
And the man, Martin, had replied,
you did, but you're a fast worker, one of the best.
And he'd held up a pair of tickets and said,
America, the land of new beginnings.
But Lily hadn't left the house with Martin. Lucy knew that she hadn't, for Lucy had locked Lily Millington in the hideaway. She was sure she could remember feeling proud when she revealed the hidden chamber. Lucy tried to say as much, but Inspector Wesley only said,
I know all about the priest hole. That's where you were hidden, Miss Radcliffe, not Miss Millington.
And he reminded her of the bump on her head and told her that she should rest, calling for the doctor.
The child is confused again, Doctor. I fear I've worn her out with my questions.
And Lucy was confused, because it was impossible that Lily Millington could have remained in the stairwell hiding place all of this time. It had been 4 days now since Martin had come to Birchwood. Lucy could remember how it felt within the tiny cavity, how difficult it was to breathe, how quickly the air had staled, how desperate she'd been to escape. Lily Millington would have called out for release long ago. No one could have stayed in there this long. Maybe Lucy had got it all wrong after all. Maybe she hadn't locked Lily Millington away. Or if she had, maybe Martin had released her and they'd run off together, just as the inspector said. Hadn't Lily told Lucy that she'd spent her childhood in Covent Garden, that she'd learned the coin trick from a French illusionist? Hadn't she called herself a pickpocket? Lucy had presumed at the time that she'd been joking, but what if Lily Millington had been working with the man, Martin, all along? What else could she have meant when she said that she told him she needed 1 month? Maybe that's why she had been so eager for Lucy to run back to the woods, to leave them to it. Lucy's head hurt. She screwed her eyes tight. The bump must have jumbled her memories, as the inspector said. She had always placed the utmost value on being accurate, disdaining those who abbreviated or approximated, and did not seem to realise that it made a difference. And so she made a solemn decision not to say anything further until she was 100% certain that what she remembered was true and correct. Edward, naturally enough, refused to accept the inspector's theory.
She would never have stolen from me, and she would never have left me. We were going to be married,
he told the inspector.
I'd asked her and she'd accepted. I'd broken off the engagement with Miss Brown a week before we came to Birchwood.
It was Fanny's father's turn to wade in then.
The lad's in shock,
Mr. Brown said.
He's not thinking straight. My daughter was looking forward to her wedding and was discussing plans for the occasion with my wife on the very morning that she'd left for Birchwood. She would most certainly have told me if her engagement had been cancelled. She said nothing to that effect. Had she done so, I'd have had my lawyers involved, I can assure you. My daughter had a spotless reputation. There were gentlemen with far more to offer than Mr. Radcliffe lining up to ask for her hand in marriage. But she wanted to marry him. There's no way I'd have allowed a broken engagement to spoil my daughter's good name.
And then the big man broke down, sobbing.
My Frances was a respectable woman, Inspector Wesley. She told me that she wished to spend the weekend in the country where her fiancé was hosting a group at his new house. I was pleased to lend her my coachman. I would never have allowed her to attend the weekend, if not for her engagement, and she would not have asked.
This reasoning was good enough for Inspector Wesley and his Berkshire counterpart, particularly when it was further cemented by Thurston. who took the inspector aside to inform him that he was Edward's closest confidant and that his friend had never breathed a word about breaking off his engagement to Fanny Brown, let alone entering a second engagement with this model, Miss Millington.
"I'd have talked him out of it if he had," said Thurston. "Fanny was a wonderful young lady and a sobering influence. It's no secret that Edward has always had his head in the clouds. She managed to bring his feet back firmly onto the ground."
"It was your weapon that was used in the murder, was it not, Mr. Holmes?"
the inspector had said.
"Regrettably, yes. A decorative piece only. A gift from Mr. Radcliffe, as it happens. I'm as shocked as anyone that it was loaded and used in such a way."
Lucy's grandfather, having learned about the missing Radcliffe blue, had decamped by them from the Beechworth estate and was only too happy to round out the description of Edward.
"Even as a child,"
the old man told the inspector,
"he was filled with wild ideas and wilder inclinations. There were many times when he was growing from a boy to a man that I despaired. I couldn't have been happier or more relieved when he announced his engagement to Miss Brown. He seemed at last to have set himself on the right track. He and Miss Brown were to have been married, and any suggestion from Edward otherwise signals nothing more than a sad loss of his senses. Natural enough in the face of such terrible events, especially for one with his artistic temperament."
Mr. Brown and Lord Radcliffe were right, Thurston said soberly. Edward was in shock. Not only had he loved and lost his fiancée, Miss Brown, he was forced to accept that he was responsible for the horrific events, having brought Lily Millington and her associates into his group of friends.
"It wasn't as if he didn't have fair warning," Thurston added. "I told him myself some months ago that I'd noticed certain items of value missing from my studio after he and his model had come to visit. He left me with quite the black eye for even daring to suggest such a thing."
"What sort of items were taken, Mr. Holmes?"
"Oh, mere trifles in the scheme of things, Inspector Wesley. Nothing to bother yourself with. I know how busy you are. I'm just pleased to have been able to offer you some small assistance in clearing up this disturbing matter. To think of my friend being taken in by a pair of charlatans. Well, it makes my blood boil. I reproach myself for not having put it all together sooner. We're lucky Mr. Brown sent you to us."
The final nail in the coffin came when the inspector arrived one morning and announced that Lily Millington had not even been the model's real name.
"My men in London have been asking questions and looking into the records of births, deaths and marriages, and the only Lily Millington they could find was a poor child who was beaten to death at a public house in Covent Garden in 1851. Sold to a pair of baby farmers and lockpickers by her father as a child. Little wonder she didn't make it."
And so it was settled. Even Lucy had to accept that the inspector was right. They had all been taken in and swindled. Lily Millington was a liar and a thief. Her name wasn't even Lily Millington. And now the faithless model was in America with the Radcliffe blue and the man who'd shot Fanny. The investigation was closed, and the inspector and the constable left Birchwood, shaking hands with Mr. Brown and grandfather and making promises to contact their counterparts in New York City in the hope that they might thereby at least recover the diamond. Uncertain what else to do, stuck out in the country where the lazy stretch of summer had come to an abrupt end and the rain had set in, the Magenta Brotherhood returned briefly to Birchwood Manor. But Edward was a wreck, and his desolation and anger permeated the very air. He and the house were one, and the room seemed to take on the faint but foul odour of his grief. Powerless to help him, Lucy stayed out of his way. His distress was catching, though, and she found herself unable to settle to anything. She was beset, too, with an uncharacteristic apprehension about the stairs where it had all happened, and took to using the smaller set at the other end of the house instead. Finally, Edward could stand it no longer. He packed his things and sent for a carriage. 2 weeks after Fanny was killed, the curtains were closed, the doors were locked, and two horse-drawn carriages thundered up the lane from Birchwood Manor, carrying them all away. Lucy, sitting on the back seat of the second one, had turned as they left, watching as the house receded further and further into the distance. For a second, she thought that she saw one of the curtains in the attic shift. But it was just Edward's story, she knew, the night of the following playing on her mind. Chapter 28. Back in London, nothing was the same. Edward departed almost at once, travelling to the continent and leaving no forwarding address. Lucy never saw what became of his final painting of Lily Millington. After he had left, she dug up the hidden key to his studio and went inside, but there was no sign of it there. In fact, all trace of Lily was gone. The hundreds of sketches and studies had all been pulled from the walls. It was as if Edward had known even then that he was never again going to paint inside the Hampstead Garden studio. Claire, for her part, did not stay long either. Having given up her pursuit of Thurston Holmes, she married the first wealthy gentleman who asked her, and was soon happily enough ensconced within a large, soulless country house of which grandmother was predictably enamoured. She had two babies in quick succession, fat little wrigglers with wide cheeks and milky jowls, and on occasion, over the years, when Lucy went to visit, spoke vaguely about having a third if only her husband would deign to spend more than a week each month at home. By 1863, the year that Lucy turned 14, it was only mother and her left at home. It seemed to have happened so quickly that each was left as stunned as the other. Finding themselves in a room together, they would both look up, surprised, before one of them, usually Lucy, made an excuse to leave, saving each the difficulty of having to invent a reason to explain the lack of conversation. Lucy, as she grew into adulthood, eschewed love. She had seen what it could do. Lily Millington had left Edward and it had broken him, and so she avoided love. That is, she avoided the complication of locking hearts with another human being. For Lucy had fallen deeply in love with knowledge. She was greedy for its acquisition, impatient with her own inability to absorb new information quickly enough. The world was just so utterly abundant, and for each book that she read, each theory that she came to understand, 10 more branched out before her. Some nights she lay awake wondering how she could best divide her lifetime. There simply wasn't enough of it for a person to ensure that they learned everything they wished to know. One day when she was 16 years old and sorting through the items in her bedroom in order that a new bookcase might be moved up from the study, she came across the small suitcase that she had taken with her to Birchwood Manor in the summer of 1862. She had pushed it to the back of the cupboard beneath the window seat when she returned, wanting to forget the entire episode, and hadn't given it another thought in the intervening 3 years. But Lucy was a sensible girl, and so despite not having expected to turn up the suitcase, now that she had, she decided that it made no sense at all to avoid dealing with the items inside. She unlatched the case and was pleased to see her edition of The Chemical History of a Candle lying on top. Beneath it were two more books, one of which she remembered finding on the top shelf at Birchwood Manor. Lucy opened it now, gently because the spine was still hanging by only a few fine threads, and saw that the letters were still there. The designs for the priest holes precisely where she'd put them. She set the books to one side and took up the item of clothing that had been packed beneath it all. Lucy remembered at once it was the dress that she'd been wearing that day, her costume for the photograph that Felix was going to take down by the river. Someone must have removed it after she fell, for when she woke in the yellow-striped room at the public house, she had been wearing her nightdress. Lucy remembered packing the costume away afterwards, balling it up and pushing it to the bottom of her case. It had given her an unpleasant feeling then, and now she held it in front of her, testing to see whether she was still spooked by it. She wasn't. She was sure she wasn't. Her skin did not heat. Her heart did not race. Nonetheless, she had no wish to keep the item. She would put it out for Jenny to cut up for cleaning rags. First, though, because it was something that she'd been taught to do when she was young, she checked the pockets, expecting to find nothing but lint and the inside lining of the fabric. But what was this? A hard, round item at the bottom of a pocket. Even as she told herself that it was one of the river stones she'd collected at Birchwood Manor, Lucy knew better. Her stomach knotted, and an instant wave of fear flooded her system. She didn't need to look. It was as if by touching it, a rope had been pulled and a curtain lifted, and now light shone onto the dusty stage of her memory. The Radcliffe Blue. She remembered now. It was Lucy who had been wearing it. She had gone back to the house in a tantrum, no longer needed for the photograph, and whilst exploring in Edward's room, she had come across the diamond pendant. Ever since they had walked together to the village, Lucy had found herself thinking of Lily Millington, seeing her through Edward's eyes, wishing to be more like her. And holding the necklace, she had perceived a way to feel, just for a moment, what it was like to be Lily Millington, to be stared at by Edward and adored. Lucy had still been looking at herself in the mirror when Lily Millington appeared behind her. She'd slipped the necklace from her throat and been about to put it back inside the box when the man, Martin, arrived and tried to take Lily with him. Lucy had dropped the blue into her pocket instead. And there it was still, exactly where she'd put it. Lucy had come to believe the inspector's story about Lily Millington, but once she found the Radcliffe blue, the stitch at the centre of the tapestry was cut, and the rest of the picture, so carefully embroidered, began to unravel. Quite simply, without the theft of the heirloom, there was no motive. And while officials in New York had verified that a couple travelling under the names of Mr. and Mrs. Radcliffe had arrived and been registered at the port, anyone could have used those tickets. The last person Lucy had seen holding them was that awful man, Martin. Edward had seen him fleeing from the house. He might have used one of the tickets and sold the other. He might have sold them both. There was also the matter of the secret chamber in the staircase. For Lily Millington to have gone with Martin, she would have had to let him know where she was hiding and he to figure out the trap door. Lucy had needed instructions, and even then it had been tricky. It would have taken time for the man to find Lily, and further time for him to solve the lock's puzzle. But Fanny had arrived so quickly, and Edward soon after that. There simply hadn't been long enough for Martin to liberate Lily Millington. Besides, Lucy had seen the way that Lily Millington had looked at Martin in genuine fear. She had seen, too, the way Lily looked at Edward. And Edward had loved Lily Millington absolutely. There was no doubting that. He had been a ghost of himself after she disappeared. That Lily Millington had disappeared was not in question. No one had glimpsed her since that day at Birchwood Manor. Lucy had been the last person to see her when she was locking Lily Millington inside the hideaway. Now, back at Birchwood Manor, 20 years later, Lucy stood up and plaited her fingers together, flexing her hands in an old gesture of anxiety. She let them fall gently to her sides. There was nothing for it. No use stalling now. If she were going to start a school in this place, and she felt very strongly that she must, then she had to know the truth. It would not change her plans. There was no way to go back and no point wishing things had turned out differently. Lucy lifted the chair to one side and knelt down, regarding the stairs rise. It really was an ingenious design. There was no way anyone would find it if they did not know that it was there. During the Reformation, when Catholic priests were hunted by the Queen's men, such places must have provided great comfort and safety. She had researched since and found that 6 men's lives were saved by this very priest hole. Bracing herself, Lucy pressed the edges of the rise and opened the trap door. Chapter 29. As soon as she had looked inside the secret chamber, Lucy closed the panel again. Emotion, suppressed for so long, overwhelmed her, and she let out a single great hiccuping gulp of grief. For all the years since finding the diamond in which she'd carried alone the secret knowledge of what she'd done, for Lily Millington, who had been kind to her and who had loved her brother, and most of all, for Edward, with whom she had broken faith, leaving him all alone in the world by believing the inspector's story. When she could finally breathe again, Lucy went downstairs. She had known in her heart what she would find within the staircase hideaway. More importantly, she had known in her head. Lucy prided herself on being a rational woman. She had thus come armed with a plan. She had gone through each of the eventualities from the safe distance of London and devised a clear set of tasks. She had thought herself prepared, but it was different, being here. Lucy's hand was shaking too much to write the planned letter to Mr. Rich Middleton of Duke Street, Chelsea. She hadn't counted on that, the way her hands would shake. And so she went for a walk to the river to steady her nerves. She reached the jetty sooner than she had expected and headed towards the woods. Without meaning to, Lucy realised that she was tracing, in reverse, the very path that she had run that day, from the photo shoot back to the house. Within the copse was the clear spot in the woods where Felix had planned to take the photograph. She could picture them all now in their costumes. She could almost see herself 13 years old and filled with the burn of injustice, darting off across the wildflower meadow towards the house. Soon to find the diamond pendant, to take it from its velvet box and put it at her own neck, to show Lily Millington the hiding place and start the terrible ball rolling. But no, she refused to see her phantom 13-year-old self take flight. Lucy walked back towards the river instead. When she had discovered the Radcliffe blue within her suitcase in London, she had known immediately that she had to hide it. The trouble was deciding where. She had considered burying it on Hampstead Heath, putting it down a drain, throwing it into the duck pond in the Vale Heath, but her conscience picked holes in every idea that she had. She knew it was irrational to imagine that a wily dog might somehow discern the very place that she had buried the jewel, dig it up and then carry it home, or that a duck might eat it, digest it, and then deposit it on the bank for an eagle-eyed child to find. It was equally irrational to believe that if such an unlikely scenario were to occur, the diamond would then be traced back to her. But guilt, Lucy had learned, was the least rational of the emotions. And in truth, the rediscovered heirloom leading attention back to Lucy was only part of her worry. What mattered more to her, and did so increasingly with each passing year, was how much suffering would have been for naught if the official scenario were now to be disproved. Lucy could not bear to think that Edward's wandering might have been prevented, that if she had told the truth sooner, he might have grieved for the loss of Lily Millington, but that he might then have been able to put her to rest and get on with his life. No, the diamond had to stay hidden so that the story would continue to be believed. It had all gone too far now for anything else to be acceptable. But Lucy would know, and she alone would live with her knowledge. Given that there was no way of going back in time and doing things differently, eternal guilt and isolation seemed like a fitting punishment. She had intended to put the pendant in the box with everything else, but now, suddenly, as she stood by the edge of the Thames, such a different river here from the one she knew in London, she felt a need to be rid of it even sooner. The river was the perfect place. The earth gave up her secrets easily, but the river would carry its treasure out to the fathomless sea. Lucy put her hand into her pocket and withdrew the Radcliffe blue pendant. Such a brilliant stone. So very rare. She held it up to the light one last time. And then she threw it into the river and started back towards the house. The box arrived 4 days later. Lucy had placed the order in London before she left, telling the man that she would write again to let him know when and where she needed the item delivered. She had considered the possibility that the order would be unnecessary, the money wasted, but the odds, she decided, were not in her favour. She chose a coffin maker and undertaker by the name of Mr. Rich Middleton of Duke Street, Chelsea, giving him specific instructions as to the unusually small dimensions required, along with a short list of other specifications.
"Triple lead-lined?"
he said, scratching the thatch of hair beneath his tattered black top hat.
"You'll not be wanting all that, surely. Not for an infant's coffin."
I said nothing about an infant, Mr. Middleton, and I did not ask for your opinion. I have told you my requirements. If you are unable to meet them, I shall take my business elsewhere. He held up his pinkish, soft-looking hands and said,
"It's your coin. If you want triple lead lines, then that's what you'll have, miss."
Millington. Miss L. Millington. It was a brazen choice and an unusual nod to sentiment. But she could hardly give her real name. Besides, Edward was dead and it had been 20 years since Fanny was shot. No one else was looking for Lily Millington. Not anymore. When he had finished writing down the details, Lucy had him read them back to her. Satisfied, she asked him to draw up an account so that she could make a payment.
"Will you be requiring a cortege? Some mutes?"
Lucy told him that she would not. The small coffin, when it arrived at Birchwood Manor, was brought grudgingly by a railway porter who struggled to lift it from the cart. It had been packed in a wooden travel crate, and there was no outward indication of what it was that he was delivering. The man was maladroit enough to ask. "A bird bath," Lucy told him. "Marble, I'm afraid." Generous gratuity was paid, after which the man's spirit improved considerably. He even agreed to move it closer to its intended position, the garden bed to the side of the front gate. It was where Lily Millington had been standing on the day that Lucy, looking for Edward to tell him about the secret hideaways, had found Lily instead on her way to post a letter.
"I want to be able to see it from as many windows as possible," Lucy told the railway porter, even though this time she had been asked no question.
When he had gone, she opened the travel crate to inspect its contents. Her first impressions were that Mr. Rich Middleton of Duke Street, Chelsea, had done a very good job. Lead was essential. Lucy had no way of knowing how long the box would remain hidden, but having spent her life reading obsessively about the treasures of the past, she knew that lead did not corrode. She wanted to hide things, certainly. She hoped that they would remain concealed for a very long time, but she could not bring herself to destroy them. To that end, Lucy had specified that the lid must seal securely. Too often, archaeologists uncovered pots that had survived the ages only to open them and find that the contents within had perished. She did not want air or water finding their way inside. The coffin must not leak or rust, and it must not crack over time, for it would be found one day. Of that she was certain. Lucy spent the next few hours digging. She found a shovel in the field barn and carried it up to the front garden. Her muscles ached, unaccustomed to the repetitive motion, and she had to stop every so often to rest. She realised, though, that stopping only made it harder to start again, and forced herself to push on until the cavity was deep enough. At last, it was time to fill the coffin. First, Lucy enclosed the copy of Demonology, which contained the letter by Nicholas Owen and the plans for Birchwood Manor explaining the priest holes. She had climbed into the attic and been glad to find the box of costumes where they'd left it. The white dress that Lily Millington had been wearing when she modelled for Edward was still amongst them, and Lucy had wrapped the bones from the priest hole carefully within it. Now she set the bundle gently inside the box. 20 years had not left much behind. Last but not least, she put in a letter that she had written, cotton paper, non-acidic, outlining what she knew of the woman whose mortal remains now lay inside the coffin. It had not been easy to learn the truth, but finding information about the past was what Lucy did best, and she was not the kind of person to give up an inquiry. She had needed to rely on almost everything that Lily Millington had told her and everything that Edward had reported and the details that came back over time from what the man Martin had said that afternoon at Birchwood Manor. Bit by bit, she had put the story together. The house above the bird shop on Little White Lion Street, the pair of rooms in the shadow of St. Anne's, the early years spent by the river slipping back across time to the birth of a baby girl in June 1844, to a woman named Antonia, the eldest daughter of Lord Albert Stanley, and a man called Peter Bell, a clockmaker, who had lived at number 43 Wheatsheaf Lane, Fulham. Lucy sealed the lid just as the sun was starting to slip behind the gables. She realised that she was weeping. For Edward, and for Lily, for herself too, and the guilt from which she would never be free. The porter had been right. The coffin was very heavy, but years spent in nature had made Lucy strong. She was also determined, and so she managed to heave the box into the ground. She filled in the dirt and patted it down hard on top. Any latent religious inclinations that Mr. Darwin had not killed, Lucy's life experience had vanquished, and so she did not say a prayer over the fresh grave. Nonetheless, the moment called for ceremony, and she had given much thought as to how she might best mark the spot. She was going to plant a Japanese maple tree on top. She had already procured it, a lovely sapling with pale bark, and the most elegant limbs, long and even, fine but strong. It had been one of Edward's favourite trees. The leaves were red in spring, turning by autumn to a most beautiful bright copper colour, just like Lily Millington's hair. No, not Lily Millington, she corrected herself, for that had never been her real name.
Albertine,
Lucy whispered, thinking back to that mild Hampstead afternoon when she had seen the shock of red in the glasshouse at the bottom of the garden and Mother had instructed her to take two cups of tea in the finest china.
Your name was Albertine Bell.
Birdie, to those who loved her. Lucy's attention was on the patch of flattened dirt in the garden bed by the front gate, so she did not notice, but by some strange trick of the dusk, just as she spoke the words, the attic window seemed ever so briefly to glow, almost as if a lamp had been switched on inside. 11. I told you I did not understand the physics of it, and there is no one here to ask. Somehow, without understanding how or why, I was out of the hideaway and in the house again, moving amongst them as before, and yet nothing like before. How many days passed? I do not know. 2 or 3? They were no longer sleeping here when I returned. The bedrooms were deserted at night, and during the day, one or another would arrive to fetch an item of clothing or some other personal effect. Fanny was dead. I heard the policeman talking about poor Miss Brown, which explained the gunshot, but not the thump. I heard them speaking, too, of the Radcliffe Blue and the tickets to America. The policemen also spoke of me. They collected everything they could pertaining to me, to Lily Millington. When I realised what they believed, I was aghast. What did Edward think? Had he been told the same theory? Did he accept it? When he finally came back to the house, he was pale and distracted. He stood at the desk in the Mulberry Room, staring out towards the river, turning to gaze sometimes at my clock, the minutes sliding by. He ate nothing. He slept not at all. He did not open his sketchbook and seemed to have lost all interest in his work. I stayed with him. I trailed him wherever he went. I cried. I shouted, I begged and pleaded, I lay down beside him and tried to tell him where I was. But my abilities in that area have grown with time. Back then, in the beginning, it just exhausted me. And then it happened. They all left, and I could not make them stop. The carriages retreated along the coachway, and I was alone. For such a long time, I was alone. I evaporated, returning to the warmth and stillness of the house, slipping between the floorboards, settling with the dust, disappearing into the long, dark quiet. Until one day, 20 years later, I was pulled back together by the arrival of my first visitor. And as my name, my life, my history was buried, I, who had once dreamed of captured light, found that I had become captured light itself. Part 4. Captured Light. Chapter 30. Summer 2017. Day broke with the sort of electric clarity reserved for the morning after a night of storms. The first thing Jack noticed was that he wasn't in the god-awful uncomfortable bed in the malt house. He was somewhere even less comfortable, and yet he felt far more buoyant than usual. The lush tangle of green and purple wallpaper told him where he was. Ripe mulberries and an engraving above the door that read, "Truth, Beauty, Light." He had slept on the floor of the house. A stirring on the sofa beside him, and he realized that he wasn't alone. Like a kaleidoscope shifting into place, the night before came back into focus. The storm, the failure of the taxi to come and pick her up, the bottle of wine he'd bought on a whim at Tesco. She was still asleep, delicate, with her short, dark hair cut around her ears. She was like one of those teacups in fancy places that Jack had a knack for breaking. He tiptoed down the hallway and into the kitchen in the malt house to make them tea. When he carried the 2 steaming mugs back, she was awake and sitting up, the blanket wrapped around her shoulders. "Morning," she said.
"Morning."
"I didn't go back to London."
"I noticed."
They had talked all night, truth, beauty, and light. The room, the house, had some sort of magic in it. Jack had told her about the girls and Sarah, about what had happened in the bank, just before he left the police force, when Jack had gone in against orders and come out with 7 rescued hostages and a gunshot wound to the shoulder. He had been a hero, all the papers said so, but it had been the last straw with Sarah.
"How could you, Jack?" she'd said. "Didn't you think about the babies, the girls? You could have been killed."
"There were babies in the bank too, sir."
"But not yours. What kind of father are you going to be if you can't even see that there's a difference?"
Jack hadn't had an answer. Not long afterwards, she'd packed up the girls and told him that she was going back to England to live closer to her parents. He told Elodie about Ben too, who had died 25 years ago on Friday, and how it had broken his dad. Elodie in turn told him about her mother's death, also 25 years ago, and her own father, who was similarly weighed down by grief, but with whom she'd decided she was finally going to speak when she returned to London. She told him about her friend Pippa and the way she felt about her work and how she'd always thought it might make her a little odd, but that now she didn't mind. And finally, because they seemed to have talked about everything else, and the omission was notable, he'd asked her about the ring on her finger, and she told him that she was engaged to be married. Jack had felt a disappointment far out of proportion for what he considered reasonable, given that he'd known her for the sum total of 40 hours. He'd tried to keep it casual. He'd expressed congratulations, and then asked her what the lucky man was like. Alistair, Jack had never met an Alistair he liked, was in banking. He was nice, he was successful, he could be funny at times. "The only thing," she said with a frown, "is that I don't think he loves me."
"Why? What's the matter with him?"
"I think he might be in love with someone else. I think he might be in love with my mother."
"Well, that's unusual in the circumstances."
She had smiled despite herself, and Jack had said, "But you love him." She didn't answer at first, but then, "No," she said, and it sounded as if she might have surprised herself. "No, I really don't think I do."
"So you're not in love with him, and you think he's in love with your mother. Why are you getting married?"
"The whole thing is arranged, the flowers, the stationery."
"Ah, well then, that's different. Stationery in particular. Not easy to return."
Now he handed her a mug of tea and said, "Come for a walk in the garden before breakfast." "You're going to make me breakfast?"
"It's one of my specialities, or so I've been told."
They went out through the back door near the malt house, under the chestnut tree and across the lawn. Jack wished he'd brought his sunglasses. The world had been washed clean, everything as bright as an overexposed photo. As they rounded the corner into the front garden, Elodie gasped. He followed her gaze and saw that the ancient Japanese maple had come down in the storm and was lying now across the flagged path, its gnarled roots pointing towards the sky.
"My museum colleagues are not going to be happy," he said.
They went over to perform a closer inspection and Elodie said, "Look, I think there's something down there." Jack got down on his knees and reached into the hollow, dusting the distant smooth speck with his fingertips. "Maybe it's your treasure," she said with a smile. "Right in front of you all along.
I thought you said that was a children's story."
"I've been wrong before."
"I guess we should dig it up."
"I guess so."
"But not until we've had some breakfast."
"Certainly not until we've had breakfast," she agreed. "Because I heard a rumour that it's your speciality and I'm expecting big things from you, Jack Rowlands." Chapter 31. Summer 1992. Tip was in his studio when the news came, a phone call from the woman who lived next door to them. Lauren was dead, killed in a car accident somewhere near Reading. Winston was distraught. The daughter was coping. He had reflected on that later. Coping. It seemed an odd thing to say about a six-year-old girl who had lost her mother, and yet he knew what the woman, Mrs. Smith, had meant. Tip had only met the child a handful of times and knew her as the diminutive person who sat across from him at the odd Sunday lunch, trying to be surreptitious as she watched, wide-eyed and curious, over the tabletop. But he had seen enough to know that she was different from Lauren at the same age. Far more internal. Lauren had exuded a wound-up energy since the day she was born, as if her voltage were set a little higher than everybody else's. It made for a fascinating kid. She was certainly a success, but there was nothing easy about her company. The light was always on. After he was given the news, Tip put the telephone receiver back in its cradle and sat down at his workbench. His vision glazed as he took in the stool on the other side. Lauren had sat there just last week. She'd wanted to talk about Birchwood Manor, asking him where it was exactly.
"The address, you mean?"
He'd given it to her, and then he'd asked her why, whether she was thinking of visiting, and she'd nodded and said that she had something very important to do and that she wanted to do it in the right place. "I know it was only a children's story," she'd said, "but in some way that I can't explain, I'm the person I am today because of it." She'd refused to be drawn further, and they'd changed the subject, but when she was leaving, she said, "You were right, you know. Time makes the impossible possible." He'd read about the concert she was playing in Bath in the newspaper a few days later, and when he saw who the other soloists were, he'd realised what she'd meant. She'd been planning to say goodbye to someone who had once meant a great deal to her. She had sat on that very same stool 6 years earlier, when she returned from New York. He could picture her the day she'd come to visit him. He'd been able to see at once that something had happened. Sure enough, she had fallen in love, she said, and she was getting married. Congratulations, he'd said. But her expression made it clear this wasn't an ordinary announcement. It turned out that the two parts of the sentence fitted together in a rather more complicated way than he'd assumed. She had fallen in love with one of the other young musicians invited to be a part of the quintet, a violinist. It was instant, she said. It was fierce and complete and worth every risk and sacrifice, and I knew at once that I would never feel the same way about another man.
And did he?
It was mutual.
But?
He's married.
Ah.
To a woman called Susan, a lovely, sweet woman, who he's known since he was a boy and whom he couldn't bear to hurt. She knows everything about him. She's a primary school teacher and she bakes the most delicious chocolate and peanut butter slice, which she brought to the rehearsal room and shared with all of us before sitting on a plastic chair and listening to us play. And when we finished, she cried, Tip. Cried, because the music had moved her. So I can't even hate her, because I could never hate a woman who is moved to tears by music. Which might have been the end of it, but there was a third part to the story. I'm pregnant.
I see.
Not planned.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to get married. And that's when she told him what Winston had proposed. Tip had met the lad a couple of times, a musician too, though not like Lauren, a good sort, hopelessly in love with her.
He doesn't mind?
About the baby, no.
I was going to say that you were in love with someone else.
I've been very honest with him. He said it didn't matter, that there were different types of love and that the human heart did not admit limitations. He said I might even change my mind in time.
He could be right.
No, it's impossible.
Time is a strange and powerful beast. It has a habit of making the impossible possible.
But no, she'd been adamant. She could never love another man in the same way that she'd loved the violinist. But I love Winston too, Tip. He's a good man, a kind man. He's one of my best friends. I know it's not usual.
No such thing in my experience.
She'd reached across to squeeze his hand.
What will you tell the child?
Tip had asked. The truth, if and when she asks. Winston and I agreed on that.
She?
Lauren had smiled then. Just a feeling. She. The girl. Elodie. Tip had found himself watching her occasionally, in turn, across the table at Sunday lunch, mildly puzzled because he recognised something in her that he couldn't articulate at once. She had reminded him of someone. He realised now, in the sudden focus of her mother's death, that she'd reminded him of himself. She was a child whose still waters masked her depths. Tip went over to the shelf where he kept his jar of whatnots and took out the stone, weighing it in the palm of his hand. He could still remember the night the woman Ada told him about it. They'd been sitting out the front of the pub in Birchwood. It was summer and dusk, so there hadn't been a lot of light, but enough for him to show her some of the rocks and sticks he'd been collecting. His pockets were always full at that time. She'd picked each one up in turn and looked at it closely. She had liked collecting things too, when she was his age, she said. Now she was an archaeologist, which was a grown-up version of the same thing. Do you have a favourite? She'd asked. Tip told her that he did and handed over a particularly smooth piece of oval-shaped quartz.
Did you ever find something as good as this?
Ada nodded. Once, when I was not much older than you are now.
I'm 5.
Well, I was 8. I had an accident. I fell from a boat into the river, and I couldn't swim. Tip could remember becoming alert then with recognition. He had a feeling he'd heard this story before. Down I went, through the water,
all the way to the bottom.
Did you think that you were going to drown?
Yes.
A girl did drown in the river over there.
Yes, she agreed gravely, but not me.
She saved you.
Yes. Just when I felt that I could hold my breath no longer, I saw her, not clearly, and only for a moment, and then she was gone, and I saw the stone, shining, surrounded by a light, and I just knew somehow, as if a voice had whispered in my ear, that if I reached out and grasped it, I would survive.
And you did.
As you see, a wise woman once told me that there were certain items that brought a person good fortune. He'd liked the sound of that and had asked her where he could get one for himself. He explained to her that his father had just been killed in the war and he was worried about his mother because it was his job now to look after her and he wasn't sure how to do it. And Ada had nodded wisely and said, "I'm going to come and see you at the house tomorrow. Would that be all right? I have something I'd like to give you. In fact, I have a feeling that it belongs with you. That it knew you'd be here and found a way to get to you." But it must be a secret between them, she'd said, and then she'd asked whether he'd found the hidden chamber yet, and when Tip said that he hadn't, she whispered to him about a panel in the hallway, and Tip's eyes had widened with excitement. Next day, she'd given him the blue stone.
"What will I do with it?"
he'd asked as they sat together in the garden at Birchwood Manor. "Keep it safe, and it will do the same for you." Birdie, who'd been sitting beside him, had smiled her agreement. Tip no longer believed in amulets or good luck, but he didn't disbelieve either. What he did know was that the idea of the stone had been enough. Many times as a boy at Birchwood, but more so after they'd left, he'd held it in his hand and closed his eyes, and Birdie's words had come flooding back into his mind. He would remember the lights in the dark, and the way he'd felt when he was in the house, as if he were enveloped and everything was going to be all right. Thinking of Lauren and the little girl, who was now without her mother, Tip began to have an idea. He had a trove of trolleys in his studio, each loaded with items he had found when he was out walking, things that spoke to him for one reason or another, because they were honest or beautiful or interesting. He began to pick out some of the finest, arranging them on the bench before him, returning some to the trays, exchanging them for others, until he was happy with the selection. And then he began to mix up the clay. Little girls liked charm boxes. He had seen them at the markets on Saturdays, lining up at the craft stalls, looking for little cases in which to keep their treasures. He would make one for her, Lauren's daughter, and he would decorate it with all of the items that meant the most to him, the stone too, for it had found a new child to protect. It wasn't much, but it was all that he could think to do. And maybe, just maybe, if he did it right, when he gave the gift to her, he would be able to imbue it with the same powerful idea, the same light and love that the stone had held when it was given to him. Chapter 32. Summer 1962. She parked the car on the verge and turned off the ignition, but she didn't get out. She was early. The wave of memories had been behind her all day, threatening to break, and now that she'd stopped, it had rolled over the top of her and spread out in a glittering wash. Juliet was beset, suddenly, with a visceral remembrance of the night they'd arrived off the train, the four of them, weary and hungry, no doubt traumatized after being uprooted from London. It had been one of the most horrific periods in her life, the destruction of her home, the loss of Alan, and yet, in some ways, Juliet would have given anything to go back. To step through that gate over there into the Birchwood Manor garden and know that she would see 5-year-old Tip with his hair like a curtain, B, a surly pre-teen too proud to accept a hug, and Red, just Red, irrepressible, with those stubborn freckles and the gap-toothed smile. Their noise, their squabbles, their incessant questions, the stretch of time between now and then,
the impossibility of going back, even for a minute, was a physical pain. She had not expected it to feel like this, for her connection to the house to pull so hard at her chest. It wasn't a weight upon her. It was a great sudden pressure inside her, pressing against her ribs in its urge to escape. It had been 22 years now since Alan had died. 22 years that he hadn't lived, in which she had gone on ahead without him. She didn't hear his voice anymore. And now here she was, her car parked on the verge outside Birchwood Manor. The house was uninhabited. She could see that at once. It wore the patina of neglect. But Juliet couldn't have loved it more. Sitting in the driver's seat, she took the letter from her bag and read through it quickly. It was short and to the point, not his usual style, little more than today's date and a time. Juliet still had every letter that he'd sent her. She liked knowing that they were all there in hat boxes in the back of her wardrobe. Beatrice liked to tease her about her pen pal, though since Lauren had been born, she didn't have as much energy for stirring. The clock in the dashboard clicked forward a minute. Time was passing at a snail's pace. Juliet didn't much fancy sitting in the confines of the Triumph for another 40 minutes. She glanced at herself in the rearview mirror, checked her lipstick, and then, with a decisive breath, hopped out of the car. She followed the winding lane towards the cemetery, blinking away the ghostly image of Tip, stopped along the way to search for odd pieces of quartz and gravel. She turned left towards the village, and as she reached the crossroads, was pleased to see that the swan was still there. After a minute of consideration, she summoned up the courage to go inside. 34 years since she and Alan had arrived from London on the train, Juliet doing her best to conceal her pregnancy. She had half expected Mrs. Hammett to arrive at the door to greet her, to start talking as if they'd only just had dinner the night before. But there was a new young woman behind the bar. "Changed hands a few years ago now," she said. "I'm Mrs. Lamb, Rachel Lamb." "Mrs. Hammett, is she..." "Not likely. She's moved in with her son and daughter-in-law down the road."
"Close by?"
"Too close, forever popping in here to give me advice." She smiled to show that she was speaking fondly. "You might catch her before a midday nap if you hurry. Takes it like clockwork." Juliet hadn't thought to visit Mrs. Hammett, but she followed Rachel Lamb's instructions anyway and arrived soon enough at the cottage with the red front door and black letterbox. She knocked and held her breath.
"I'm sorry, you've missed her," said the woman who answered. "Down for the count, and I don't wake her. She can be testy when she hasn't had her winks."
"Perhaps you could mention me to her," said Juliet. "She might not remember. I'm sure she saw so many guests come and go, but she was kind to my family and me. I wrote an article about her, she and her WVS ladies."
"Oh, well, you should have said so. Juliet of the Laneway. She still has a framed copy on the wall beside her bed. Her claim to fame, she says."
They exchanged pleasant chat for a few more moments, and then Juliet said that she ought to be going. She was meeting someone soon, and Mrs. Hammett's daughter-in-law said that it was just as well as she had some pantry sorting to be getting on with. Juliet was turning to leave when she noticed the painting on the wall above the sofa, a portrait of a striking young woman.
"Beautiful, isn't she?" said Mrs. Hammett's daughter-in-law.
"Intoxicating. Came to me from my grandfather, discovered in his attic after he passed away."
"What a find."
"Quite the hoard, I assure you. Took us weeks to clear it, mostly rat-eaten rubbish. His own father had the house before him."
"Was he an artist?"
"A policeman back in the day. When he retired, his boxes of old notes were put up top and forgotten. Don't know where she came from. She's unfinished. You can tell by the edges, where the colour isn't right and the brush strokes are rough. But there's something in her expression, don't you think? You can't help but look at her."
The woman in the painting stayed with Juliet as she started the walk back towards Birchwood Manor. She wasn't familiar, not exactly, but the essence of the painting was reminiscent of something. Everything in her face, her expression, radiated light and love.
It made her think of Tip for some reason, and Birchwood Manor, and that sunlit afternoon in 1928 when she'd fought with Alan and become lost and then found again, when she'd woken up in the garden beneath the Japanese maple tree. No surprise, of course, that she should think of that day now. Juliet and Leonard had been exchanging letters for almost 20 years, ever since she wrote to ask him to contribute to a Laneway article she'd planned to write but never got around to, about the many different lives led in one house. He'd received the letter too late, as it happened, and by the time he wrote back, she was in London again and the war was wearily winding down. But they'd stayed in touch. He also liked writing, he said. He got along better with people on the page. They had shared everything, all of the things she couldn't write in her columns, the anger and grief and loss. And by turns, the things that happened to them along the way, the beautiful, the funny, the true. But they had never met in person, not since that afternoon in 1928. Today would be the first time. Juliet hadn't told anyone what she was doing. Her children were always encouraging her to go out for dinner with one eligible fellow or another. But this, today, him, was impossible to explain. How could she ever make them understand what she and Leonard had experienced, the two of them, that afternoon in the garden of Birchwood Manor? And so he remained her secret, this journey back to the house their own. The Twin Gables came into view, and Juliet felt herself begin to walk faster, almost as if she were being pulled along towards the house. She put her hand in her pocket to check that the tuppence was still there. She had kept it all this time. Now, at last, she could return it. 12. Jack and Elodie have gone for a walk together, the two of them. She said something about wanting to see the clearing in the woods for herself, and he was only too happy to offer his services as a guide. And so here I am, sitting again in the warm spot at the turn of the stairs, waiting. One thing I know for certain, I will be here when they get back. I will be here too when they are gone and my next visitors arrive. I might even tell my story again someday, as I did to little Tip and before him, Ada, weaving together threads from Edward's night of the following with the things my father told me about my mother's flight from home, the tale of the Eldritch children and their fairy queen. It is a good story, about truth and honour and brave children doing righteous deeds. It is a powerful story. People value shiny stones and lucky charms, but they forget that the most powerful talismans of all are the stories that we tell to ourselves and to others. And so I will be waiting. When I was alive and the great craze came first upon society, spiritualism and the desire to communicate with the dead, there was an assumption that ghosts and apparitions longed for release, that we haunt because we are trapped. But it is not so. I do not wish to be set free. I am of this house that Edward loved. I am this house. I am each whirl in each piece of timber. I am every nail. I am the wick in the lamp, the hook for a coat. I am the tricky lock on the front door. I am the tap that drips, the red rust circle on the porcelain sink. I am the crack in the bathroom tile. I am the chimney pot and the black snaking drainpipe. I am the air within each room. I am the hands of the clock and the space in between. I am the noise you hear when you think you're hearing nothing at all. I am the light in the window that you know cannot be there. I am the stars in the dark when you feel yourself alone.
Author's note. I share Lucy Radcliffe's anxiety about the number of subjects to be studied and grasped within the limits of a single lifetime. So one of the best things about being a writer is having the opportunity to explore topics that fascinate me. The Clockmaker's Daughter is a book about time and timelessness, truth and beauty, maps and map-making, photography, natural history, the restorative properties of walking, brotherhood, having three sons shot that one to the top of the list, houses and the notion of home, rivers and the power of place, among other things. It was inspired by art and artists, including the English Romantic poets, the Pre-Raphaelite painters, early photographers such as Julia Margaret Cameron, Charles Dodgson, and Matthew Brady, who first described the camera as the eye of history, and designers like William Morris, with whom I share a passion for houses and who drew my attention to some of the unique ways in which the buildings of the Cotswolds mimic the natural world. Places that lent thread to the weave of this novel include Avebury Manor, Kelmscott Manor, Great Chalfield Manor, Abbey House Gardens in Malmesbury, Laycock Abbey, the Uffington White Horse, the Barbary Hill Fort, the Ridgeway, the countryside of Wiltshire, Berkshire and Oxfordshire, the villages of Southrop, Eastleach, Kelmscott, Buzzcott and Lechlade, the River Thames, and of course, London. Should you wish to visit a house with genuine priest holes, Harvington Hall in Worcestershire retains 7, designed by St Nicholas Owen. It also sits upon a moated island. If you are eager to read more about 19th century London and the streets occupied by Birdie Bell and James Stratton, some useful sources include London Labour and the London Poor by Henry Mayhew, providing insight into such forgotten occupations as the blind street sellers of tailor's needles and scrievers or writers of begging letters and petitions. Victorian London, The Life of a City, 1840 to 1870 by Liza Pickard. The Victorian City, Everyday Life in Dickens's London by Judith Flanders. The Victorians by A.N. Wilson. Inventing the Victorians by Matthew Sweet. And Charles Dickens by Simon Callow, being a deeply affectionate biography of one of the greatest Victorians and Londoners. The Seven Dials is still a bustling pocket of Covent Garden. However, should you visit now, you'll find more restaurants and fewer shops selling birds and cages than when Mrs. Mack was running her enterprise. Little White Lion Street was renamed Mercer Street in 1938. I was inspired by a number of museums whilst writing The Clockmaker's Daughter, which seems fitting given the novel's focus on curation and the use of narrative structures to tell cohesive stories about the disjointed past. Some of my favourites include the Charles Dickens Museum, the Watts Gallery and Limner's Lease, Sir John Soane's Museum, the Fox Talbot Museum, the Victoria and Albert Museum, the British Museum, and the Royal Observatory at Greenwich. I was thrilled to attend the following exhibitions and am grateful to galleries and curators who make such works available. Julia Margaret Cameron at the V&A 2015 to 2016, Painting with Light, Art and Photography from the Pre-Raphaelites to the Modern Age, Tate Britain 2016, Victorian Giants, The Birth of Art Photography, the National Portrait Gallery 2018. With special thanks to Lizzie Kramer and all at DHA, my editors Maria Raitt and Annette Barlow, Lisa Keim and Carolyn Reedy at Simon & Schuster, and Anna Bond at Pam Macmillan. Thanks also to the many people at ANU, Belinda, Pan Macmillan and Atria, who played a vital role in turning my story into this book and sending it out into the world so beautifully. Isabel Long generously provided information about the world of the archivist, and I am grateful to Nitin Chowdhury and his parents for assistance with the Punjabi terms in Ada's story. All errors are of course my own, whether intentional or not. I have, for instance, taken the liberty of situating a Royal Academy exhibition in November 1861, even though during the 19th century the annual exhibition of the RA opened in May. Those who helped in less specific but no less important ways while I was writing The Clockmaker's Daughter include Herbert and Rita, precious departed friends who are still in my thoughts, my mum, dad, sisters and friends, especially the Cretchys, Paddos, Steinies and Browns, every single person who read or listened to and enjoyed one of my books, my three lights in the dark, Oliver, Louis, and Henry, and most of all, for too many things to count, my life co-pilot, Davin.
Belinda hopes you enjoyed the reading of The Clockmaker's Daughter, written by Kate Morton and read by Joanne Froggatt. Our audiobooks are becoming increasingly popular among travellers, families, and people who are on the go. If you really enjoyed this audiobook, please introduce your friends and family to the experience. If you want to hear more about our fabulous range of titles, please visit us online at belinda.com. Thanks for listening, and remember to always take a Belinda audiobook with you.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.